Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
After months of silence, we're hearing snippets about negotiations between the City of Phoenix and the Suns. Phoenix contends state law allows them to keep details about arena options confidential during the negotiation process. But council members are complaining they're being kept in the dark. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes has been following the issue and joins me now. Christina, you were at yesterday's council meeting where there were some members expressing frustration with this process.
Yes, Councilwoman Kate Gallego, who's running for mayor, led the charge. In a nutshell, she asked, "Where's the report?" Then several other council members jumped in. It's been 10 months since the council approved a $75,000 contract for a consultant to study arena options. Then yesterday they approved another $125,000.
And what's this consultant supposed to be studying?
Well, let's go back to February, because that's when the council hired the consultant, Barrett Sports Group, to study a range of options for the city-owned arena where the Suns play. The to-do list was supposed to include what it would cost to renovate or build a new arena for basketball, and then also what it would cost to renovate or build new for basketball and hockey, presumably for the Coyotes, who've expressed interest in leaving Glendale.
But this whole arena review stems from the Suns owner Robert Sarver saying the team needs a better place to play.
Yes, the Suns have a potential out in their lease agreement with the city. There's something called, bear with me in case I screw this up, an obsolescence clause that kicks in about 5 years. Basically, it says if the building's obsolete, the team can leave.
I'll brave this as well. So since obsolescence clause is a legal phrase, that means the definition is open to debate.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's open to negotiation. Most people think of obsolete as being out of date or no longer useful. But that could mean one thing to a team playing in a 25-year-old facility and something else to a mayoral candidate like Kate Gallego. Here she is asking staff to provide details from the consultant.
When this item first went forward, we were told they would come up with a list of costs for the arena. For example, how much we would need to have a good functioning plumbing system, which seemed like a reasonable cost to me, and then other costs, which I, for one, would not prioritize in these difficult budget times, such as spending a lot of money upgrading suites, luxury suites. And so I had asked to get a list of the work product and have not been able to see that yet.
Councilman Sal DeCiccio quickly backed her up, saying it's a reasonable request, and others joined in. Assistant City Manager Milton Dahoney Jr. told the council they've identified some things that need to be done now, like plumbing issues, but
there are other things, however, that have been identified as clearly needed in terms of infrastructure. But we have not taken steps to begin actions on those because it was pointed out to us those would better be addressed within the realm of a renovation if one was going to occur.
So what he's saying is we know there are things that need upgraded or fixed, but we really don't want to start messing around until we know whether we're doing a big renovation, and if so, who's going to pay for what. While no specific dollar amount has been floated for renovations, most people around City Hall use the phrase hundreds of millions of dollars.
And has the consultant ruled out anything? As we've heard, maybe the hockey team would come there as well.
Well, that's what Councilman Jim Waring wanted to know. Listen to this exchange between Waring and City Manager Ed Zuercher.
Are we doing the hockey or not? Because that was much discussed. Haven't heard much about it recently.
Mayor, Councilman Waring, that the whole question of hockey is actually part of the negotiations with the Suns. So I don't want to get into that at this point.
We know Councilman Jim Waring is against spending public money on sports facilities. Who else have you talked to?
I've reached out to all council members at least twice, maybe three times since October, to get their take on using tax revenue from hotel stays and car rentals to either pay for arena upgrades or to build a new one. Kate Gallego has been the only one to join Waring in the absolutely not, no way camp. Two others, Councilwoman Deb Stark and Councilman Sal DeCiccio, are open to renovations if it's what they consider a good deal for taxpayers, with the team splitting the cost. In an email last month, Councilman Daniel Valenzuela, who's also running for mayor, said, quote, "The practice of placing the undue financial burden on sports venues on our taxpayers needs to end." Then during yesterday's meeting, he voted to spend more on the consultant's study, saying it's an important issue and Phoenix needs to continue to maximize efforts at the city-owned facility. And finally, I should say I've received no responses from Vice Mayor Laura Pastor and Council Members Thelda Williams and Michael Nowakowski.
Anyone in the definitely yes camp?
Well, no one's saying yes because they're still waiting to see a list with all the costs. While Mayor Greg Stanton is arguably the Suns' biggest cheerleader, he repeated his pitch that the arena is about more than basketball games.
That building is currently busy over 200 nights per year, and obviously it supports many businesses. Many people are employed inside and outside of that arena as a result of how busy it is.
I've been trying to verify that number, that over 200 nights per year, because I've heard it a lot. I asked Phoenix to provide a calendar of arena events, and they directed me to the Suns because the team actually operates the arena. I explained to the Suns that the city uses this over 200 phrase, and I'd like to know how they came up with it. After three requests over a two-month period, I'm still waiting.
Well, so what are the next steps now with the council and negotiations?
The city manager told council members they will get an update, including a list of immediate needs and costs, when they meet in executive session next month.
Executive session means behind closed doors, right?
Yes. So what they discuss is considered confidential while they are negotiating. But based on the passionate comments at yesterday's meeting, I expect we will hear details as soon as a decision to make a deal with the Suns or not is reached.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow is the deadline to enroll in health insurance plans through the Federal Exchange for 2018. This year's open enrollment period was shorter. Consumers have had half the time to sign up as in past years. Some have gotten help from navigators, people who guide you through the ins and outs of coverage options. We wanted to know what these navigators have noticed this enrollment period, so we reached out to the Cover Arizona Coalition. It's provided free help in exploring the federal marketplace, as well as Medicaid and kids care. Marcus Johnson is with Cover Arizona Coalition. He's also Vitalist Health Foundation's Director of State Health Policy and Advocacy. Marcus, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. So what have you noticed with the time constraints, a shorter enrollment period this year?
I will say the first thing that we've noticed is that Cover Arizona and the navigators and the sisters have been busy. People in Arizona have been enrolling at record pace. As of, I believe it was yesterday, new numbers were released showing that about 88,000 Arizonans have already signed up for health insurance on the marketplace, while at the same time last year, 76,000 Arizonans had signed up. So the navigators and the sisters are extremely busy, and Arizonans are enrolling at a record pace right now.
To what do you attribute that?
I really think that it's because of the fact that community partners, some traditional and non-traditional, have really stepped up and helped with advertising and getting the word out. We've seen a lot of hospitals, we've seen health insurance companies, local churches, and other community-based organizations really trying to help get the word out and build as much awareness in their individual communities.
With the shorter time window, and also there were fewer resources to advertise about the deadline and get the word out, how did your organization and how did other organizations try to really make better use maybe of the resources and the time that you did have?
It's thinking creatively. It's reaching out to churches, to hospitals. I know that in Southern Arizona, there's a coalition of community partners that got together and created different advertisements, both in social media and on television. We've really been leaning heavily on a number of community partners to help spread the word. In some communities, it really is a grassroots effort. I know that in Yuma, Arizona, for instance, word spreads really quickly around smaller communities. So just trying to think creatively about how we can build outreach.
Are you trying to do anything? I mean, we hear in politics so much about like micro-targeting, really trying to get to the individual person or maybe a particular family that you're trying to reach. Have you been trying to employ those kinds of methods as well?
Well, one of the things that we did strategize about before open enrollment started is we asked the question, who's not thriving? Who out there really could benefit from gaining access to health insurance coverage? And when you look at the populations in Arizona that don't have as much access, Hispanic populations tend to have lower numbers of insured populations. So we did a lot of targeted media outreach and targeted outreach to Hispanic and Spanish-speaking populations under the assumption that if we can build awareness in these populations, that folks can actually find affordable health insurance coverage that they might not know have existed.
There is criticism, as you no doubt know, of the Affordable Care Act in the marketplace, the exchange, that for a lot of consumers, there aren't a lot of options or there aren't a lot of affordable options. Are you finding that shoppers in Arizona are finding plans that they are happy with and that they can, in fact, afford?
We're seeing a lot of surprise on behalf of consumers in Arizona because there are a significant number of plans that are very, very affordable. We actually estimate that about 100,000 Arizonans could qualify for free monthly premiums. That's 100,000 Arizonans that wouldn't have to pay a monthly premium for their marketplace plan. And many are really surprised to learn this.
Are you finding that shoppers are confused or nervous about the future of the ACA? I mean, there's been so much talk about repeal and replace and then other efforts to maybe do that. And then there's some provisions in the tax bill dealing with the Affordable Care Act. Do consumers really have a sense of what the law is and what it will be going forward?
So there's no doubt that there's a significant amount of confusion existing right now. You've had the cost-sharing reductions that were eliminated. You had decreases in funding to both the Navigator organizations, decreases in funding to marketing and outreach from the new administration. And that has led to increased confusion. But fortunately, the Cover Arizona Coalition and CoverAZ.org have provided kind of a one-stop shop where Arizonans can go onto a website to figure out, can I get one-on-one assistance with identifying the best options for my family? So, yes, there is confusion, but there's also remedies, and there are safe, free, and affordable places for folks to go to get answers for this confusion.
All right. Marcus Johnson is with the Cover Arizona Coalition, also Vitalist Health Foundation. Marcus, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
County prosecutors in Arizona, like Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery and Pima County's Barbara LaWall, are elected, but a huge percentage of voters across the country aren't sure whether their prosecutors are elected or appointed. That was a jumping-off point for the ACLU to conduct a national survey of 1,600 likely voters. 42% identified as Republicans, 41% as Democrats, and 17% as Independents. Taylor Pendergrass, senior campaign strategist for the ACLU, is with me to go inside the numbers. Taylor, what were you trying to find out with this survey?
The problem, as we see it, of mass incarceration and the really stark racial disparities in the criminal justice system, and have recognized increasingly that elected prosecutors have played a major role in creating both of those problems. And we are interested in figuring out what the public knows about their local elected prosecutor and what their preferences are when it comes to that person, in part because there are over 1,000 elected prosecutors who are up for election in 2018. So we were surprised to find that there had never been a national poll of the public's attitudes towards elected prosecutors. And so we set out to find a little bit more information about what the public generally thinks about their elected prosecutor and the type of person that they would like to see in that position. So we asked the public how much they know about their elected prosecutor and found that, you know, just about half of them even knew that their prosecutor was elected. So there's certainly a large information gap out there among the public about how much they know about who that person is or what their roles or responsibilities are. But when we educated the public about that, what polling firm found is that the public overwhelmingly, across party divides, across, you know, ideological divides, prefers a prosecutor who is committed to reducing incarceration and who is committed to addressing racial disparities in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, some of those numbers, as you mentioned, were overwhelming. 89% of voters saying it's very important for prosecutors to actively work toward ending mass incarceration with alternatives to prison. Did any of the results surprise, even once you found out that about half of people didn't know their prosecutors were elected? Because we're not talking about 65, 70%. We're talking about 89% on one, 88%, 91%. These numbers are huge.
That's right. You know, generally, when you find over half of respondents feel strongly about a particular issue, you consider that to be a really strong finding. And here, as you mentioned, the numbers are really, really strong. About 90% indicating that they want prosecutors to prioritize reducing mass incarceration. And I think we found these results to be very surprising. You know, the overwhelming majority of elected prosecutors for years, if not decades, have run on tough on crime platforms and have generally promised to seek the harshest penalties possible and to put people in prison for as long as they can. So seeing this overwhelming public support for a new and different direction, I think, is quite shocking. And I think it speaks to the lack of information that the public has about what type of policies their local prosecutor is pursuing. And we feel very confident that as the public gets more information about who their local elected prosecutor is, that we will start to see these very strong preferences show up at the ballot box, and that prosecutors who move away from kind of traditional tough-on-crime philosophies and embrace, you know, principles of rehabilitation and reducing mass incarceration are going to be able to get elected to office and can start tackling the very real problems we have in our criminal justice system.
And the timing is striking on this because we have heard, at least publicly, members of both sides of the aisle, the discussion about the need for sentencing reform, the need for overall reform when it comes to this. So it seems as though these paths are coming together to some extent. Are you seeing that momentum as well?
Yeah, I think the time is really ripe for the type of reforms that, you know, as you mentioned, people on both sides of the aisle are talking about. And I think this poll just reinforces and maybe even expands the sense that people of all political parties in red states and in blue states recognize that the criminal justice system is in dire need of an overhaul. And, you know, both incumbent prosecutors and candidates or people who might think about running, I think can look at the results of this poll and say that the public is really behind them when it comes to addressing these problems.
And Taylor, one more thing. As we mentioned, some of the results are really striking. As we said, 89%, 88%, 91% in terms of people favoring these changes. The most important question sometimes is, can this help to affect change? Do you think it can?
We do. You know, I think that we started to see a real sea change with regard to the public's attention to local prosecutor races and who they wanted to vote for. In the 2016 elections, we saw people who ran on criminal justice reform platforms be elected as top prosecutors in cities as diverse as Tampa, Florida, Orlando, Chicago, St. Louis. One of the reasons that the ACLU is focused on elected prosecutors is because they have so much power within the criminal justice system. About 90% of cases are resolved by plea bargain, and it's the prosecutor and the prosecutor alone in those cases who's making the decision about whether someone should get an alternative to incarceration or whether someone should go to prison. So, you know, we really do think that once these public preferences show up at the ballot box and we get more prosecutors committed to these types of changes, we're going to start to see real policy reforms in these offices that are going to result in major changes in the criminal justice system.
All right. Taylor Pendergrass is senior campaign strategist for the ACLU. We've been talking about a new poll that shows Americans overwhelmingly support prosecutorial reform. Taylor, thanks for the time this morning.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Whistleblowing has been an important part of reacting to workplace corruption and oppression and trying to bring about dramatic change. In recent decades, whistleblowers have been treated with greater respect by the general public. But there's also been a stronger backlash, putting whistleblowers in danger of losing their livelihoods, their savings, and more. Tom Devine is legal director of the Government Accountability Project and has represented a number of whistleblowers. And Tom, how would you say whistleblowers are faring these days?
For whistleblowers, this is the best of times and the worst of times. It's the best of times because we've won a legal and cultural revolution. Since the millennium, we've passed 15 whistleblower statutes all unanimously. There's no other issue in the country that has such deep bipartisan support from the politicians. And that reflects a complete change in attitude by the public. Instead of being viewed as nuts or traitors, whistleblowers are now respected and admired as the public's eyes and ears. People who risk their careers to defend the public against abuses of power by government and corporate bureaucracies. That's wonderful. Whistleblowers have also making more of a difference than at any other time in history. And that's the whole point of freedom of speech, is to have an impact. And they're consistently slaying Goliath. You know, for myself, we haven't lost a case since 2006 representing whistleblowers, even though they're always the underdog. They're proving the power of the truth. The worst of times, though, is the more difference they make, the more intense the retaliation gets, because bureaucrats are threatened more by them.
Tom, what are some of the methods of retaliation that are being used against whistleblowers now?
The forms of retaliation are getting more intense, and they're getting uglier, and there's too many holes in the wall in terms of the rights that whistleblowers have. And as a result, the government's just shifted to new tactics. instead of firing the people who challenge abuses of power, they put them under criminal investigation and give them the choice of resigning or getting indicted. And if they don't resign, they can face indictment. And this new tactic of criminalizing whistleblowing is even scarier than firing people. If it's frightening to think of losing your job, it's downright terrifying to think that you're going to be put in jail because you challenge the powers that be. I don't expect that I'm ever going to be able to be on one of your programs or anyone else's and say, well, we've had a happy ending to this. This is a timeless struggle. But the whistleblowers have been winning every battle since the millennium, and so we're on a roll.
Are there certain industries now that trouble you more than others, or that there's a greater need for whistleblowing, or you're seeing more whistleblowers in those industries?
Two industries that really stand out are the healthcare industry and the defense industry. And the reason we know that is the success of America's most effective anti-corruption law, which is a whistleblower statute called the False Claims Act. It allows whistleblowers to do more than make noise. They can actually file suits on behalf of the taxpayers to challenge fraud in government contracts. And the healthcare industry and the defense industry have been 1-2 for decades in those suits. And these whistleblowers are averaging over $1 billion a year in recovery in civil frauds, primarily from those two industries. And it's been getting better and better for the whistleblower's impact, but more and more discouraging for the report card and corporate integrity. Over the last few years, they've recovered over $3 billion in fraud recoveries, primarily from the healthcare and defense industries.
Tom, do you see any reason to think that the current administration is going to lead to more kinds of whistleblowing, and in part because of when President Trump came in, there were phrases like draining the swamp, and Steve Bannon talked about threatening traditional institutions. I mean, should we expect there to be a need for more whistleblowing because of that?
Well, I'm afraid that what we may see is a little bit of schizophrenia. President Trump's intolerance for criticism of himself or his own policies speaks for itself, and that's not too optimistic for future whistleblowers on the Trump administration. On the other hand, President Trump kind of ran as a citizen whistleblower, challenging abuses of power by big government. And a lot of the whistleblowers backed him because they were challenging abuses of power by big government, government bureaucracies. When it comes to people who've been blowing the whistle on the Obama administration, President Trump's been excellent, been kind of a cheerleader for them. He set up a whistleblower office at the Veterans Administration. Some of his early appointments, like at the Office of Special Counsel, which is the Federal Whistleblower Protection Agency, have been excellent. So the jury is out what's going to happen with this administration. But traditionally, most political parties have been big supporters of whistleblowers on their opponents and have been pretty intolerant of people who blew the whistle on them. And that's a much larger phenomenon than the current administration.
Tom Devine is director of the Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. And Tom, thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
ASU recently hosted a forum examining the outside effects of climate change on indigenous peoples. Tribal leaders and members, along with scientists, scholars, and activists, got together to examine why Native American tribes were more vulnerable to Earth's changing weather patterns and what can be done about it. The keynote speaker was a former Department of Interior official who's recently made news as a whistleblower against the Trump administration. KJZZ's Phil Lastman spoke with him, and he joins us now. Hey, Phil.
Hey, guys. His name is Joel Clement, and for 7 years he worked on the issue as the director of the DOI's U.S. Office Policy of Analysis. He traveled to places like Alaska to see for himself, and now he finds himself unemployed after leaving the agency. And I started out our conversation by asking him what happened.
Well, when the new administration came in, when the Trump administration came in, they clearly deprioritized climate change work. I was the climate change lead at the agency. So it took them a few months, but they reassigned me this summer in June, took me away from my work supporting Alaska Native villages addressing the impacts of climate change. So when they reassigned me, they sent me to the office that collects royalty checks from the oil and gas industry. So it was clear they wanted to get me to quit. So I blew the whistle and registered a whistleblower complaint with the Office of Special Counsel. And there's an ongoing investigation there. But after 2 or 3 months of trying to stick it out in that new position they gave me, it was clear that there was no interest in doing the work that I find very important right now. So I resigned in early October to just keep my voice out there. I had already essentially lost my job. I didn't want to lose my voice. So that's why I'm continuing the drumbeat on these issues now from outside the agency.
Why is it so important for you to be a whistleblower, and what are you exactly trying to blow the whistle on?
Well, you know, the big problem is the abuse of power and the ethical issues that are coming up at the Department of the Interior. So, you know, when I was reassigned, they reassigned dozens of us at one time with the clear intent, we believe, to get us to quit. And that's a dangerous precedent, because that's when you, one of the important things about the civil service is that it remains independent in terms of political priorities. In other words, we're there to implement the work and to implement the laws and regulations created by Congress. We are not allowed to, nor is it advisable that we be getting involved in political work. So they were politicizing the civil service, and that's a real dangerous precedent. So I felt it was important not only to blow the whistle, but to go very public with this, because it's not just about climate change. It's about broader issues about governance.
For the past 7 years, you just talked about you'd been working on climate change issues, Joel. Specifically, how it's affected Indigenous or Native American communities. I know you spent time in Alaska studying this. Why have they been hit harder than others? And I guess the second part of that question is, why does the Trump administration not feel it's important?
Well, it has, in fact, been a lot tougher on tribal communities than others. In fact, with all of these ongoing changes, the less resilient communities right now are getting hit the hardest. By that, I mean the poorer communities, communities of color, because they don't have the services that the wealthier communities have. So in particular, the Alaska Native communities are real. They're out there on their own up there in the Arctic, and the permafrost is melting out from underneath their feet, literally. So they're vulnerable to the next big storm, and their villages could be washed away. I mean, it's a matter of life and death for these folks. In the lower 48, it's not usually quite that dire, but certainly, services to tribal communities have always been lacking, and that's something we really need to focus on. Now, the Trump administration, when they came in, made it clear right from the start that tribal sovereignty and tribal assistance was not going to be at the top of their list of priorities. And that's borne out certainly in the actions they've taken since, particularly, and I think most publicly, last week with the announcement about shrinking Bears Ears by 80%. That national monument was a priority for the tribes in the region.
Yeah, some might say that it's just too late to do anything, that climate change is kind of irreversible. As a former government official who knows the subject matter, can anything really be done to mitigate this?
Well, absolutely. You know, we have to immediately pivot away from fossil fuels and get on the renewable resources out there. And that will make a big difference. Now, it's not going to change things for the next 10, 20, maybe 30 years. Those changes are locked in. But after that, we can be making a big difference right now if we get off the fossil fuels. And this is one of the things that I think is important for tribes in the West, because they have these great wind and solar resources. And with the federal government stepping away from renewable energy right now, tribes could own this energy transformation in the West, you know, own the leases, own the projects, own the jobs. And make sure that this renewable energy transformation is employing locally and training up Indians, and that Indian country can then be seen as a real economic driver for this change that's absolutely coming, whether this administration likes it or not.
Joel Clement is former director of the U.S. Office of Policy Analysis with the Department of Interior, and now he is a whistleblower speaking out against the department's stance on climate change and other issues. Joel, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me on.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Water, they say, is for fighting over, and A recent land deal in northwestern Arizona is yet another example of that. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports on a plan to buy property to get a hold of its water.
Dennis Rule works at the agency that runs the Central Arizona Project. The CAP brings Colorado River water to the Metro Phoenix area. It also replenishes groundwater in the valley. Rule, however, grew up in Tennessee, where flooding is a big concern. Walking the halls of the CAP's offices, he recalls a conversation he had with a hometown friend.
Telling him about how we have fights over effluent, sewage. And he was just flabbergasted. It's like, you fight over sewage? And I said, yes, it's an important water supply.
Almost every drop in Arizona is an important water supply and can lead to fights. And there's one going on right now. Dennis Rule and the CAP are trying to buy farmland in between Bullhead City and Lake Havasu City. They want its Colorado River water rights. They'd fallow some of the land and use that irrigation water to replenish groundwater in central Arizona. The purchase is getting major pushback from residents.
The whole reason the Phoenix area and Tucson area wants the water is so that they can grow. Okay, so why steal it from us and hinder our growth just so they can grow?
Karen Summit is a real estate agent in Mojave Valley.
I've been here since the 70s, and I've seen this place start to grow and then stall out, and it's wonderful to see it start growing back.
Summit thinks a potential home builder might want that water allocation. If it's committed to Phoenix, for example, it can't be used for homes in Mojave Valley. John Pineker runs the Bullhead Area Chamber of Commerce. He says when bigger employers shop around for a location, they look for employee housing.
As these businesses continue to grow and get staffed and we add new businesses, those people aren't going to have houses. And depending on the business, they won't be able to get a water allocation either.
So the Mojave Valley wants the water for the same reason Central Arizona wants it, for development. The CAP's Dennis Rule.
There is a lot of discussion and a legitimate issue of, you know, connecting land use planning and water supply. But I would say that that is a broader discussion.
And Rule, as a water manager, can't wait for the broader discussion. He needs agreements like these. Why? Well, if Phoenix developers plan to use groundwater for new homes in Arizona, they have to enroll in CAP's groundwater replenishment program. It's meant to maintain the level of the aquifer. As the program grows, the CAP has to find more and more water for replenishment. State law mandates it.
We need to develop additional reliable water supplies for our existing obligation.
In this case, it's getting a new water supply by making a private land purchase. The CAP is buying the farmland from a hedge fund company, about 2,200 acres, for $34 million. There's a local board that has a role here, the Mojave Valley Irrigation and Drainage District. It can allow water to leave the area or not. The board has 5 members, all large landowners or representatives of large landowners. One member works for the seller of the farmland in this deal. He's recused himself. The board declined requests for an interview. John Pineker of the Bullhead Area Chamber of Commerce doesn't see why his area's water should be shipped off to satisfy demand elsewhere.
If I lived in Wisconsin and me and my neighbors wanted a mountain by us, we couldn't go and hire somebody to move a mountain to us. I don't understand the whole why you have to provide them with water. You know, move to where the water is.
The water war continues next month when the Irrigation Board meets again. If it allows the water transfer, the state would review the deal, then make a recommendation to federal regulators. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Well, my name is Sean Emerson. People ask me, how do I maintain 6 golf courses? And I tell them I don't. I maintain 1, and I just repeat myself 6 times.
Turn it on.
And we start our daily procedure of mowing grass. And we just change the directions the mowers go and create special patterns. Raking the rocks and the bunkers.
Man.
Well, this is our pump station that we use to water the golf courses. We can do about 3,000 gallons a minute. You're playing a sport, but you're also dealing with nature, and it's a moving target. So my job is to keep moving.
That's Sean Emerson maintaining the golf courses at Desert Mountain. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we deserve a mulligan, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Good morning, and thanks for joining us on the show. With Mark, I'm Steve, and still to come this hour, a tiny desert concert. But first,
the Phoenix City Council last night approved a framework for addressing the increasing number of structured sober living homes in the city, as well as a timeline to have it in place by mid-March. The group Take Action Phoenix has been working on this issue for nearly a year. Jeff Spellman is a volunteer with the group, and he joins me. So, Jeff, tell me how it went for you yesterday.
While TAP generally agreed with the plan that was put forth by city staff, we still had three main sticking points in that. And those were, one thing that we brought up since day one is the city has no comprehensive map even showing where all of the group homes are at. The second one was that as part of the licensing process, and that really is how the city is going to effectively regulate group homes, is through licensing of them, that there would be not only an inspection to get their initial license, but also an annual inspection. And then the third thing was some process for reviewing reasonable accommodation requests. So as group home operators put in their applications to operate a group home, they'll either, you know, have the right to be where they apply. But if they don't, then they have the opportunity to submit a reasonable accommodation request. And the way it stands today is the ultimate decision-making authority in that disability request lies in one single individual, and that's the director of the Planning and Development Department at the City of Phoenix. We had a lot of problem with that and the fact that there was no provision for community input in hearing that reasonable accommodation request. So, long story short, last night the City Council, they did approve by a vote of 8-1 the comprehensive package and timeline with some modifications. And those modifications addressed the three main concerns that we had.
So did you basically get everything you wanted?
We absolutely got everything that we wanted. And it's not just a victory for Take Action Phoenix. As we left the meeting, we were talking to the representative from the industry who represents the Arizona Recovery Housing Association. The conversation we had at the end was this is headed in the right direction. And this whole idea of having some sort of citizen involvement, citizen review of the reasonable accommodation package was met very well with both the industry and with Take Action Phoenix.
Within this entire framework, what to you is the most significant, or maybe the couple most significant aspects that you think will really address the issue that groups like yours and others have had with sort of this explosion of sober living homes and group homes in the city?
You know, what we want to end up with is something that works, something that creates a safe and healthy environment, number one, for the residents who live in the group homes. And if it's safe for them in their home, it will also be safe for the neighborhoods where those homes are located. And really what came forth in this whole thing and how to get the best control of it, there's going to be some changes to the city's zoning ordinance that revolve around distance requirements so that there's not clustering of group homes, which was part of our issue. But really how the city is going to get control of them is through licensing. And licensing is something that is totally separate from zoning. And what it is going to do is require every single group home, regardless of their size, to be licensed by the City of Phoenix. And that's going to require some inspections. It's going to be required some background checks, fingerprinting of the owners who own the houses, as well as the managers. It's going to require some standard operating procedures to be in effect that meet some sort of industry standards so that we know every house that gets licensed meets minimum levels of standards. And it's, you know, it's still a work in progress. We aren't 100% there yet, but we certainly have made major strides. and licensing is probably the key thing that's going to get that to us.
Well, as you referenced, this is obviously an issue that is not unique to Phoenix. There are a number of cities in Arizona that have dealt with this issue, a number of cities across the country. How similar or dissimilar, based on the research and the work that you've done on this over the past many months, how similar or dissimilar to what other cities have done is what Phoenix is doing?
Well, the one that we can relate to probably best is Prescott. And that was the first city in Phoenix that passed some sort of comprehensive regulation on group homes. And, you know, as we've worked through this, you know, some of the council members have actually asked us point blank, is the Prescott ordinance good enough for you? And our feeling is we're actually going to have something much better than. And I don't want to, because they were the first, you know, we're all going to learn from everybody who does something before us. But the Phoenix ordinance, we think, is going to be better than that. This is an issue that's sweeping the nation. You know, a lot of people recognize that it's probably just the tip of the iceberg of what we're seeing right now, and predominantly because of the opioid epidemic, there is going to be an increasing need for people to be in recovery. And that's a good thing. We need these kinds of facilities, but we need them to be clean and safe for the people who live in them. We need them to be clean and healthy for the neighborhoods where they're located.
All right, that's Jeff Spellman with the group Take Action Phoenix. Jeff, thanks a lot for coming back in.
You're welcome, Mark. Thanks so much.
Arizona State shook up the college football world and faced a lot of criticism when it hired Herm Edwards as its new head football coach. Edwards coached in the NFL, but has never been the top man for a college program. During an Arizona Board of Regents meeting yesterday, Edwards had his contract approved, and the board also addressed some other items. And with me for a few minutes to talk about it is Ann Ryman, who covers higher ed for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. And good morning. So the Herm Edwards contract, was that sort of a rubber stamp, or did Regents have some comments about it?
They really spent quite a bit of time discussing this. Now, because it's a personnel issue, they're allowed to go behind closed doors in executive session and talk about the contract. And so that's probably where the most interesting discussion took place. You know, but when they came out, there were some provisions that they made sure were in his contract.
And what were some of those provisions that you find important?
Well, one of them is they've received a great deal of criticism about the $12 million payout to fired coach Todd Graham. And the criticism is he gets 100% of his salary remaining on his contract. You know, even if he were to turn around and get another coaching job immediately or during that time period. So they wanted to make sure that in Herm Edwards' contract, you know, his is limited to 50% if he gets fired for what's called without cause.
And what I found a little interesting too about the Herm Edwards contract was that he at least initially is getting paid less than Todd Graham, and that it seemed to be something Ray Anderson, the athletic director, was saying was important, that he didn't take the job for the money. Did the Regents comment about that, well, I'm going to say disparity or the difference in that?
They did, but keep in mind also he has performance incentives in his contract, which could add, you know, $3.7 million a year if he does everything. Now, they would have to go to the national championship and win it in order to get that much. But, you know, it is laden with incentives, so that's an important thing that, you know, Todd Graham also had that in his contract as well, but it's important to remember that the $2 million is what's guaranteed, but he also can get money based on, you know, how the football team performs on the field and also how they do in the classroom.
So that combination is there then, because Michael Crow has been upfront about saying he wants a team that will win on the field and off the field.
Yes.
And one other question related to football is that there was, and this just struck me as well, I'm not sure if this is significant compared to Herm Edwards, but since NAU is one of the three universities the Regents is over, anything interesting to you about the NAU football coach situation?
That one kind of has been overshadowed, obviously, by this, although they have had a really, really good season. And, you know, so I think the continuation of that contract was, you know, an indication that they're very happy with the coach there.
And one other item I wanted to get to, and let me know if you can chat about this. The cost to educate a resident undergraduate is less than the national average. That was the headline in what the Regents sent out, that there's a thorough cost study done with this, because ASU and U of A and NAU have all been criticized a bit because of the rise in tuition. What did you make of what was in that report? Did you have a chance to talk about that and look into it?
I thought that was a very interesting. They had always kind of suspected that the cost might be around that amount, but what they did is they brought in kind of a third-party independent firm to look at what the cost is of educating a student. And the legislature is requiring them each year for the next 5 years to do this. So I think it's a good way of kind of comparing ourselves, you know, nationally to what's going on.
So it was a legislative requirement, but also maybe a way for those on the Board of Regents to say, you know, this is something we're actually justifying to some extent why we have approved tuition raises. So it's sort of a double-edged sword in a sense.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, this is the cost. This is their cost to educate a student. So, you know, obviously the tuition doesn't cover, in most cases, the true cost. You know, there's other revenue that they're getting, you know, other things that they have to raise money.
Ann Ryman of the Arizona Republic in AZ Central. Ann, thank you for the quick update on the Board of Regents.
Thank you.
Hundreds of firefighters are battling the Thomas Fire in Southern California. As of this morning, it's burned more than 242,000 acres and is 30% contained. But not all of the crews fighting the fire work for a governmental entity. Private firefighters have also been deployed, and with me to talk about that is Dave Torgerson. He is the president of Wildfire Defense Systems, which is a wildfire services provider based in Montana. It operates across 21 states. And Dave, first off, tell me a little bit about what your company does. Like, when do you, for example, come into a fire situation?
Sure. We primarily provide wildfire services to major insurance companies. Now, we are also under contract to the federal government, to the Forest Service, to provide firefighters and fire engines, along with lots of other companies that do that for the past 30 years.
And how do you work with first responders, you know, governmental type firefighters who are called on to fight a wildfire?
Well, first of all, what we do is supplemental to all the local, state, and federal resources. We have a task to work to increase the survivability of policyholder homes and insurer programs that we serve.
How big would you say this industry is of essentially private wildland firefighters?
Well, the National Wildfire Suppression Association has a lot of references and details, and on their site, about 40% of the, according to their site, about 40% of the nation's wildfire resources, that's equipment and personnel, are private sector. The government contracts with them typically on a three-year basis, and this has been going on back into the 80s. As it's difficult to have enough resources during a wildfire, and our local, state, and government federal providers, wildfire responders, have been augmenting their resources with private sector resources, like I say, for decades.
Is it safe to say that involvement of companies like yours in fighting wildfires has grown as time goes by?
I don't have all of those numbers from the entire private sector wildfire service, but I would say that it has not been escalating fast, just steady. Wildfires come and go, so to speak. Fire seasons are difficult and light at various times. It feels like we've been in difficult fire seasons for quite a while now. So the private sector wildfire contractors are growing. And they work in all segments of providing services, from fighting the fire, hand crews, engines, tenders, but also the camps and the tents and the, you know, catering and all those kinds of things.
Do you have crews in California right now?
Yes.
Can I ask how many firefighters you have out there battling the fires in and around L.A.?
We have about 100 people engaged currently.
Is that considered a lot for a particular incident for the types of fires that your company gets called to?
We often operate at that scale all summer long. There's lots of wildfires that have happened, and these fires in California are dramatic and severe. But it's been a robust fire season all across the West. We've been operating at this scale since probably May.
One of the criticisms of services like this, as I'm sure you know, is that this is basically extra firefighting for people who can afford it, for the wealthy. Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
No, not at all. We do the majority of the work for the insurer programs in the nation, and 90% of the homes that are in these programs are insured by average value carriers, average value homes. So about 90% of the homes are in that sector, and about 10% are high net worth, which is really just a typical cross-section, I guess, of where homes and values are. So it's not a concierge style. It's not a pay-to-play. None of the programs that we serve, is there a cost on the policy, for this. It's something that the insurers are offering. And if you have a home of any value and you want it to have these kinds of supplemental services to the extent that the insurer programs can offer, you just need to shop around with your agent or broker to learn which have these in the policies.
Have you found that there are more insurance companies and more policies offering this kind of service now than there used to be?
Well, certainly. It started in the 2000s, and we're 10 plus years into this, and so it has grown over time.
Would you anticipate that there will be more need for services like yours, both from your company and maybe from others, as wildfire season, as you said, seems to continue to be getting longer and there are more destructive wildfires and people continue to build closer to that wildland-urban interface?
Well, you can never have enough resources during a wildfire, and I'm sure the fires in Southern California are no different right now. It's difficult to marshal all the resources that you might want for a fickle and changing peril that comes up and goes away quickly. And so, these insurer programs, I think, are an important contribution to a growing wildfire problem.
All right. Dave Torgerson is president of Wildfire Defense Systems. Dave, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cecil B. DeMille's 1956 version of the Ten Commandments featured Charlton Heston as Moses, fighting against the oppressiveness of Ramses II, played by Yul Brynner.
Let my people go!
Slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God.
But DeMille directed a different incarnation of the Ten Commandments, a silent version, 3 decades earlier. And recently, archaeologists in Southern California found a sphinx used in that 1923 film. It was from the set that was buried there by DeMille, at least in part because it was too difficult to move. Scott Iman is DeMille's biographer and is with me to explain more about why the set was buried and why DeMille made 2 different Ten Commandments films. Scott, what was DeMille thinking when he decided to hide the set? He basically buried it.
Well, it was perfectly logical at the time. He needed a flat space with a great deal of sand. Because Egypt is flat and it has lots of sand. Paramount Pictures, which is where he was working, had a very small back lot. It was out of question to build the set size he wanted to build on the back lot. All the studios had ranches out in the valley they used for lavish sets that they didn't have room for in Hollywood because space in Hollywood is limited. But the Paramount Ranch was rolling. It was all rolling and it was all green, and there was no way they could convert it all into ancient Egypt. So he needed a flat space with a lot of sand, and he found Guadalupe, which is nothing but sand. And it's a long drive from Hollywood, but it was exactly what he needed, and it's close to the ocean. So he could use it to also film the Exodus. He built his set at Guadalupe, a huge set with rows of sphinxes leading into the walled city of the pharaoh. He shot the footage he needed, and then he had the problem of, what do I do with this? Now, his core problem was it was public land. It was not owned by Paramount. It wasn't owned by anybody. He simply took over the land to build the set and had guards there at night to make sure nobody was taking pictures. But when the production left Guadalupe, he was worried about have somebody coming in and bootlegging the set and shooting some quick and dirty movie and getting that wonderful set that he'd paid serious money for out to the public before he could get his film out to the public. So, not surprisingly, he decided to level it. He tore down the huge walls that he'd built. But the sphinxes, which were made out of plaster on bases, he simply kind of bulldozed over on their sides and covered them with sand. And there they lay for the next 90 years.
I mean, DeMille is one of the kings of Hollywood, certainly, in the history of Hollywood filmmaking. How did this set compare? Was this set something that was so incredibly unique? Did it just blow people away at the time?
Yes. In the late... The first huge set that was built in Hollywood was D.W. Griffith's set for Intolerance, the Babylon set, and that's 1916. And then came World War I, which kind of involved a lot of men and material, so not a lot was done in 1917, 1918. After World War I, Hollywood began competing with each other in building splendid sets. This was climaxed by Douglas Fairbanks building a huge Norman castle for his film of Robin Hood in 1922. And DeMille was essentially just raising the ante and building an even bigger set, you know, for ancient Egypt in 1923. That was about the ultimate. That was as far as they went, because Adolf Zukor, who was one of the co-founders of Paramount, along with DeMille, was convinced DeMille was going to destroy the company because he simply didn't care about money, according to Zukor. And the set and the production of The Ten Commandments was so expensive that he began maneuvering to get DeMille out of the company, because he thought DeMille's primary allegiance was to DeMille and not to Paramount.
So clearly, the 1950s version of The Ten Commandments is quite a different film. So how satisfied was he with the two films, as different as they were?
He was very proud of both of them for different reasons. He was proud of the first one because it was he was laying his marker down as a maker of an epic spectacular, which became his dominant mode of production. It's what he was known for then. It's what he's known for now. And I remember John Carradine once told me he enjoyed DeMille. He liked him a lot. A lot of actors didn't like him. But Carradine liked him. He said, because on his last day working on the Ten Commandments, DeMille came up to him and said, John, your great-grandchildren will see you in this picture 100 years from now. And Carradine said, and it looks like he was right.
What do you think DeMille would have made of all the CGI stuff, considering he loved to have these big sets?
Well, he was a man of the theater, and he liked sets. He liked physical things. All the filmmakers of that era did. They wouldn't have understood the attraction of working exclusively with green screens or blue screens. Although DeMille had to do that a lot when he shot the Red Sea parting. That was all done with the rough equivalent of blue screens today. But I'm sure he would have adopted it, you know, because he was very interested in technical things. Even though his dialogue is always firmly in the 19th century. If you look at his films, they're very modern in terms of the era in which they were made.
Was the epic what we would call the blockbuster of today, Scott? And the fact that most of the blockbusters today are based on superheroes, or there was the Harry Potter run for a long time. What do you think, as someone who's been a film historian, about how the nature of an epic has changed, and how much of that, again, is because of computers and green screens and that sort of thing?
When you look at a movie made in a DeMille picture, for instance, there's a real sense of physicality. You can feel the weight of the buildings. You can feel you can see 5,000 extras in a shot, you know, because there really are 5,000 extras in a shot. When you see a modern picture like that, Ridley Scott did a dreadful Exodus picture called, I think it was Of Gods and Kings. And, of course, he had, you know, where DeMille had 6,000 people in the Exodus in one shot, Ridley Scott had 20,000 people, but they were all little bouncing dots. You know, they were zeros and ones. They were all digital people. They weren't really people. And you could feel the difference in the emotional impact of the filmmaking. Photography doesn't lie. It does lie, but it doesn't lie, because it translates emotions, and it translates the spiritual impact of what DeMille is photographing.
Scott Eyman is a film writer. One of his books is Empire of Dreams, The Epic Life of Cecil B. DeMille.
And now for a tiny desert concert. That's when we bring local bands into the KJZZ studios to play a couple songs for us and talk a bit about the music. Today we hear the Blood Feud Family Singers. Self-described as up-tempo but downhearted, the heart and soul of the band is its poetic lyrics that pluck at your emotions, and the bluesy folk tunes take a walk down the dusty road of love and heartbreak. Daryl Scherer is the poet who pens the tragic lyrics and lends his soulful voice to the songs. His music has been nominated as one of the 10 best love songs ever written by a Phoenix musician. That's by the Phoenix New Times. We sat down to talk, and I started by asking him if he's found that his songwriting process has evolved since he's been doing it for around 2 decades.
I think it wasn't until about 10 years or something into it that I really had a handle on what it was that I had to say and what kind of songs I wanted to do.
What do you think helped you do that?
Just writing a lot of bad songs.
You had to do it to get better at it.
Yeah, I hit it a couple of times prior to that, there's a few tunes from that I still play. But it was like happy accidents. It wasn't until much later that I had a handle on it.
So what do you do differently now than before when you were writing, as you call it, bad music?
Well, I mean, honestly, now what I do is I'm working on writing a novel. I haven't been writing too many songs lately. But most of my songs have primarily been about lust and or revenge. And there's only so many ways to say those things, you know? Like, it got to where I'd sit down and just think, well, how am I going to handle lust or revenge this time? And you know, you don't want to be there. You want to come back at it fresh.
Have you found that your songwriting background is helping you write your novel?
In a way, yeah. There's a way in which I find myself sometimes kind of approaching the whole thing like I'm writing a song in spirit, where, okay, in this scene I have to get this to happen, and you know, it kind of has the same feel as like, well, I've got four lines and I've got to make A and C rhyme and then B and D rhyme. And sometimes it has that same kind of architectural feel.
Do you find yourself like maybe subconsciously rhyming the lines in your book?
Yeah, or alliterating them.
Huh.
Yeah. And then other times, like, you know, what another writer buddy of mine calls the cheesecake parts, you know, like the really sort of poetic and juicy passages or phrases that you kind of wish the whole book could be, but it just can't, or else nothing would happen. Some of the cheesecake parts feel a lot like writing songs.
So can you play a song for us?
Sure. This one is called Doors of the Dead. A 1, 2, 3, 4. Under a celluloid moon, you had the sense that your scene would end too soon. And though the strip lights were strewn across the night, you were right, if not quite ruined. You'd spoiled your face with those streaks that speak the gruesomeness of grace, where the freeze frame fades and we learn at last the cast by whom we're played. Oh, darling, hush, hush, hush. It's love that's making us. Hush, hush, hush. It's ash to ash and dust to dust. Bang, bang, bang on the doors of the dead. The ghost in the muscle like a song in your head. And the words are all true till we do what they've said. And it's bang, bang, bang on the doors of the dead. A fatherless sky, you took my hand and you walked us both inside. You had that look in your eye like someone ready to kiss this world goodbye. You said, whatever we choose, this is the kind of a game where we both lose, where what makes it so sweet is how we finally both admit defeat. You put your hand to my face and your fingers traced the gruesomeness of grace. That crack in the mask, that naked ache that would take us both to task. Yes, we welcome that guest like a ghost we've both been born to host. You pressed your face to the floor, or else whatever possessed us pressed it for you, darling. Hush, hush, hush. It's it that's having us. Hush, hush, hush. It's ash to ash and dust to dust. Bang, bang, bang on the doors
of the dead. The ghost in the moss are like a song in your head. And the words are all true till we do what they've said. And it's bang, bang, bang.
So I've got to ask you about a description that I read that I think comes from you guys about your music, and I'm quoting here, up-tempo, downhearted, poetic, philosophic, country-fried hostility for sentimental haters. Is that your words?
Yeah, I did that.
What on earth do you mean by that? There's a lot in there.
Yeah, right. I wanted to kind of, I mean, obviously the sort of rhetorical trope of all these sort of hyphenated pairs is meant to be a little comical. But I was sincerely trying to triangulate what it is we actually are up to at least in my imagining as a band. So I wanted to get across that we're gloomy, but you know, not slow and morbid that we tend to have, or morbid, but not slow. Because most of what I write tends to have a certain amount of energy in the tempo. I grew up listening to punk rock, so I get really impatient with too many slow songs. And what did I say? Up-tempo, down. Yeah. You know, all our songs are known, but that is rather presumptuous. Those who do know us know that we're fairly negative in our lyrical content. It's something, a return of the repressed about it, I suppose.
Can you play us one more song?
Sure. This one is called 100 Times, and it's on our album, No Moon.
A 1, 2, 3, 4. Girl who lives inside my head. Sometimes I think she wants me dead. Sometimes she stands so stark and dark and tall. She used to have my mother's face. She likes to put me in.
You're listening to Valley Band, the Blood Feud Family Singers, and that was the band's singer, Daryl Schur. You can see video of this performance and other Tiny Desert concerts by visiting kjzz.org/tinydesertconcert. And if you're in a band or know of one you'd like to hear play at the KJZZ studio, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
She likes to see me angry all the time.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.
And love is just another kind of